We barely have time for one more question, but I should like to recognize Professor Kenneth Black of the College of Law.
President Reitz and Mr. Vice President, my query deals with federal financing of education and is in three parts. What is your personal attitude towards such financing as compared to the financing on the local level? B, do you believe that federal subsidy of education will endanger local autonomy? And C, if federal financing becomes more general than it presently is, in other words, gets into the primary and secondary level, do you believe safeguards will be provided against the federal governmental interference? And if they are provided, will they be effective?
The question as to whether or not the federal government should assume more responsibility for the financing of education is one, as you know, that has been before the Congress and before the nation in the past couple of years and will be before this Congress as well. My position, I think, is quite well known. I served on the House Committee on Labor and Education and on the Senate Committee on Labor and Education, voted on bills of this type that involve these problems, and of course, as Vice President, have participated in the administration decisions with regard to federal aid to education. I will state my general beliefs in order and answer to your question. First, I believe that education is and should remain primarily a local and state responsibility. The closer that it can be kept to the people, the better. I have friends, and you, I'm sure, have them too, who do not share that belief, who believe that local school boards are penny-wise and pound-foolish. Sometimes they are. Who believe the state legislatures don't provide enough for the universities, and sometimes they don't. Believe that the answer is to have the federal government in Washington take over the whole thing, provide more money, and we'll have better education. And my reply to that is this. It looks good on paper, but it won't work. And the moment that you put the primary responsibility, or even a very substantial part of the responsibility for financing education at the federal level, you are going to run serious risks of impairing local responsibility, and you are also going to run the risk of federal control. Now, what should the federal government do? As you implied in one of your questions, the federal government, I think, very properly at the university level, through the Defense Education Act, for example, through the land-grant colleges, as we know, the federal government, I think, can properly, without running any serious risk of federal control, provide aid which, in effect, is designed to serve the national interest through putting emphasis on subjects and teaching, for example, which the national security requires. When you get below that at the high school and secondary level, I believe that the position that this administration has taken is the proper one. We reject a federal program, such as some senators have introduced and are supporting, in which the federal government would, without regard to need, subsidize teachers' salaries and subsidize, as well, construction throughout the country. $1 billion the first year, two the second, three, and we don't know how many the next. The moment the federal government steps into that, we'll see local responsibility for providing the necessary funds and the right kind of education withering away. I oppose that. I think that is the wrong step. What we do say is that the federal government can, however, properly assist school districts that are needy on a program in which we participate with those local districts in helping them to finance their bond programs for new construction. Now, when you're in construction alone, the possibility for control is greatly reduced. The moment that you get into subsidization of teaching, the possibilities for control inevitably, I think, are increased. And when you limit it, as has been suggested, to needy districts alone, when you limit it as we do, not in terms of a permanent program, but once the district gains the taxable property with which it can meet its educational needs, the aid, of course, will then come to an end. When you have a program of this type, I do not see any substantial risk of federal control. And on the contrary, I do see very real benefits from the standpoint of the nation at large. Because it is true, when you examine American education, that there are, in all of the states, some districts that simply do not have the property to maintain an adequate plant of public schools at the primary and secondary level. Now, we haven't the time to go into the other provisions of the bill which the administration has submitted, which the President again endorsed in his State of the Union message. I can simply conclude by reiterating the basic principle that education, of course, is a matter of federal concern as well as state and local concern. But what we want is the best education that can be produced. The best education, I am convinced, that can be produced in this country will be through keeping the responsibility as close to the people as possible, to provide for some diversification, to get away from the drab uniformity that a federally controlled program would inevitably bring. And I believe that the administration's program, for that reason, can and should have the support of people who oppose federal control, but who support an adequate educational program for the country at large, and particularly an attack on the problem of needy districts which cannot support themselves. Now, having said all this, I recognize that in this audience are a number of classroom teachers, and I might say that there's one additional one. My wife was a high school classroom teacher when I married her, but she agrees with me on this as far as the subsidization of teacher salaries are concerned at the national level. And I am sure that when you analyze the problem, that most of you will reach the conclusion that this, in our country, is the best answer to it.
We have now gone down the panel. I wonder if there is a member of the panel who would like to ask the Vice President one more question.
This is a very brief question, but recently our state cabinet, including the governor and our Secretary of State, sent a letter or a communication to Washington urging that legislation not be passed whereby bond interest on interest on bonds and revenue certificates issued by states and political subdivisions of states would be subject to federal income taxes. I wonder what your position is on that. I notice that it has been proposed. There was some suggestion that this was in consideration in Washington in the Kiplinger letter and also in the most recent issue of the United States News and World Report.
Well, if I understand the proposal correctly, I would say, first of all, that it is not one that has the approval of the administration. I don't anticipate that it will have the approval of the administration. And I would say that as far as my position is concerned, that I think that the administration position is certainly correct in this instance. I know that there has been discussion, but not at the top Treasury level. I would not expect, certainly in this Congress, or for that matter in the next one, that such a proposal would be
looked upon favorably. Could we have some, another couple of, here.
I've got one, sir. You,
yes,
you
sir.
Alluded briefly to Khrushchev's statement.
Yes.
And particularly the headline in our Times Union bothered me. Nikita Blatt boasts Reds able to lick world, and I'm particularly interested, sir, in what the administration that you're now a part of is going to do to attempt to counteract the influence of this type statement on the U.S. public.
Well, of course, Mr. Khrushchev, as you know, is one who is not bashful about, I can say that with personal experience, but he's not bashful with regard to his own strength. But I would also add this, that no matter how much he believes his strength is, he himself knows, as I suggested a moment ago, that he doesn't have enough to knock out the U.S. retaliatory power. And I can say that he is right. He does not have it, and he will not have it. Now, what kind of a program do we have at the present time? You've heard a lot about the so-called missile gap, a gap which resulted from the fact that they began to build missiles before we did, and a gap that has been the subject of a great deal of controversy. Many people, when they hear about the fact that Mr. Khrushchev may have more ICBMs than we have, assume this means that we are second and that he can, as using his terms, if they are his terms translated, can lick us. This is an oversimplification of a very complicated question. I think it's more proper to talk in terms of whether or not there is a deterrent gap. Because U.S. strength is not only in its missiles, and we have some very good ones, as the President indicated in his State of the Union message, and as you from Florida know from the Cape Canaveral failures, as well as the successes. But we also have strength in our SAC striking power, which is still a very awesome and powerful force. We also have strength in our, which is potential, in our atomic submarines, which eventually will be armed with Polaris missiles. And we also have our bases abroad and our missiles abroad as well. And I can say that as far as deterrent power is concerned, there is no gap today, and there will be no gap under the program that the President has submitted and will submit to the Congress during this session. I believe, and I have examined these defense figures very carefully, I believe that the amount that the President asks for our military defenses will provide an adequate deterrent to deter any aggressor, potential aggressor. I believe, too, that that this program projected into the future is one with which the American people can support, and one which will provide adequate security. Now, you, of course, can raise points. Well, what about the B-70, for example? That has been in the papers recently. And I can only say that you can make an argument for the B-70. That's a great new bomber with a Mach 3 speed, 70,000 feet, which will come off perhaps in 6, 8, or 10 years. And you can make arguments also for various types of interceptors, which have been cut back or the like. And the answer to all that is that every part of the service has particular weapons which it believes should be included. You can't include them all. And so somebody, and this is the President of the United States generally, has to make the decision as to which are the best for the needs of this country. And in the instance of the B-70, I think the President's decision that we would continue it on a research basis with making up planes in the future and then putting them into production only if we found then that they would be an effective instrument in our arsenal is a proper one. because the choice is between
the B-70
and between the missiles. The President made the choice. I think it is a proper choice and one that will stand inspection. And I can only say that to those who say, well, why don't we do it all? Doesn't Mr. Khrushchev do it all? And the best answer to that is that his statement today, he himself said, we're cutting back our armed forces on the ground. We are quitting the production of bombers. You know of some of his comments with regard to the Navy. Now, some of these statements cannot be taken at face value. But just remember that in the world today, neither they nor we are going to do everything. What we must do is to have an adequate force so that any aggressor will know that he cannot strike without being harmed in return. We have it. We're going to continue to have it. I'm confident of that. We think that, as usual, the lady should have the last word, so.
We don't have a microphone yet, President. Vice President Nixon, we're well aware of your goodwill trips abroad in the many nations, and we realize that you've traveled extensively in countries that people are other than white, colored races. I wonder what their feeling is about the United States as a leader in the world, and our situation of more or less limited integration?
I would answer that question by saying this, that when we look at this whole problem of civil rights, which I realize is a very difficult one, because clearly apart from my present experience, it happens that I went to school in the South. I took my law at your neighbor at Duke up here. And I recognize that the problem of integration in our schools, for example, is a difficult one in the South. I recognize, too, that it is not just a Southern problem, that the North, the West, that all over this country there are problems involving segregation and the like. And that it is not particularly appropriate for some of those in the North to point their fingers at the South without, of course, dealing effectively with the problem in their own backyards. But I also recognize, as I have said many times publicly, that no law can be written that is going to solve this problem in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. I remember that when I took contracts, and I understand you're a first-year law student with an examination in contracts Monday, is that right? That's the hardest one you'll have in law school, so get ready for it. But be that as it may, I remember my first-year law school professor, Lon Fuller, who is now at Harvard at the Williston Professor of Contracts there, made this interesting statement at the start of the course. He said, young men and young ladies and gentlemen, we have three girls, I remember. They're bright, too. In any event, he said, as you start this course in contracts, I'm going to tell you one thing, one rule that you should remember if you forget everything else. A contract is only as good as the will of the parties to keep it. Now, as far as a law is concerned, we know that a law is only as good as the will of the people to obey it. That is why when people talk in a very difficult field like civil rights in terms of a legal solution which goes beyond what is attainable, you are simply talking with, I would say, the greatest naive attitude possible. And so you have the two extremes on the one side. You have on the one side people that say, this situation is bad in the United States, we ought to do something about it, and so let's pass a law which will resolve it. You have on the other side people who say, and I've heard it said, sometimes I expect to hear it on this visit as well, they say, this is a situation which we should deal with, and
there should be no federal interference in it. I think both sides are wrong. I think the position that the administration has taken, the Attorney General has expressed in an argument in the Supreme Court just yesterday, it's a position that I feel very strongly is correct, that in these various fields that we must make progress, that we must fit the law to the problem at hand, that we must not go so far in our legal remedies that we do not honestly expect compliance with the law that we may pass. And I believe that what the administration got in the last civil rights bill, I think what it has recommended last year, which is before the Congress this year, is a program which is attainable and which is enforceable and which would have public support of most people. Now, having said that, let me get to the relationship to these travels abroad. I've been, as a matter of fact, in every one of the countries in Asia, to most of those in Africa, to some in the Near East. In this great complex of countries, as we know, there are approximately 1 billion people, and you've often heard it said that the world is divided into thirds, a third in the communist world, a third, 1 billion or so, in the free world, and a third in the so-called neutral world. Strike the word neutral, incidentally, because as far as these people are concerned, as evidenced by the welcome that President Eisenhower received there, their hearts are on the side of freedom. There's no question about that, I'm sure. Now, and incidentally, I wouldn't want to sound partisan here, but to all of those people over the past 7 years, who, and some of them have said it even within 6 months of the time the president left, who said, American foreign policy is a failure, American prestige is at an all-time low, Eisenhower is no leader, I say, well, there are about 1 million people or so in India and Pakistan and the rest that will say they're wrong and that he is a leader. And I say it tonight, too. But what these people do in India, with its 400 million, Indonesia with its 88 million, Burma with its 30 million, Malaya with about 15. What the 200 million people in Africa do, and Africa is evolving so fast now that you virtually have a new independent country every year, and you will have over the next 10 years. What they do and which way they turn will depend on the economic factors that we mentioned a moment ago, whether they can have economic progress with the climate of freedom, or whether they have to turn or forced to turn for that progress to the communist help, which means inevitably that they will be communist satellites, economic first and political next. They want economic progress, certainly, but in addition to that, there isn't any question if you travel through these countries that they also want recognition of their individual dignity as human beings. And when you look at these countries, they're very different. You've just traveled to some of them, I know. They're different in religion, different in dress, languages, but they're alike in one respect. 95% of them are not white. And I can tell you that when you travel to these countries, that every little instance of mistreatment or denial of rights to citizens in this country who are not white is blown up 1,000-fold. I don't know of anything that does more harm to U.S. foreign policy abroad than instances of this type. I imagine that this Parker case in Mississippi, the communists and probably some that aren't communists are spreading leaflets by the thousands through Asia and Africa at the present time. Now, what is the answer? The answer, of course, is twofold. One, there's got to be a better story told abroad about what we are doing in this field. We have made some real progress. A lot of progress has been made in the South, too, incidentally, in education. A lot of progress has been made in other areas as well. The very fact that Americans are concerned about denial of voting rights, denial of adequate education, denial of employment opportunities to our Negro citizens is an indication of potential progress in the future. But I can just say in conclusion that while you can make a case in this instance
for civil rights on a legal basis. You can make a case on a moral basis, and there you will have argument. There isn't any argument at all about the international effect. If the United States expects to retain its prestige in the world, among these nations, we have to deal with this problem. They don't expect us to solve it magically because they have it too, somewhat in reverse. But we have to deal with it. We must be honest about it, and we must do the best we can. And so I can just say in conclusion, this is the last question, so I know you have your examination to prepare for. I would be the last to suggest to this great audience that I see any easy solution to civil rights. We started with that question. We might as well finish with it. I can assure you this, getting back to my little allegory of a moment ago, analogy, that passing a law isn't going to solve it. Laws can help in certain areas, but it isn't going to solve it. In the final analysis, it's going to be solved by the young people in this audience who go into the communities in Florida and throughout this South and throughout the North and the West, if you come from the North and the West. And I can only say that in this area of human relations, race relations, labor relations, leadership at the top helps. But basically, you have to have men and women of goodwill at the local level who recognize the problem and then patiently work out these very complex and difficult issues in a way that will meet the approval of the community. And the very fact that these questions have been asked tonight, that there is interest, I can see from the replies that on both sides of the issue, I think speaks well for the future. I'm not discouraged about it. I think we've come a long way in the last 10 years particularly. And I believe that the young people in our colleges and universities throughout this nation can render tremendous service in this area and others in providing America the leadership that it needs. And thank you very much. I just want to thank you for being so patient, and so that we don't end on such a serious note, I want to say that I'm honored from a number of respects, but to be on in a basketball floor, on the floor, is something for me. I went out for both football and basketball, but always sat on the bench. And speaking of football, incidentally, I understand among the issues you've had down here is... The only thing I'm wondering about is this. You know, I roomed with a boy from Georgia at Duke who had gone to Macon, but he was a good, I was going to say rebel, but any event. And I noticed that Florida must be a very trusting university, because tonight at the reception I met a man that I saw play many years ago, Catfish Smith, and he's from Georgia, and here he is down here. Working with the ROTC, and then here you go up to Georgia and get a football coach, and Georgia's your biggest rival, so you really have goodwill in this state, I'm sure. Thank you.
Mr. Vice President, I know I speak for this entire audience in expressing our very deep appreciation for your coming with us tonight, sharing your views and thoughts, and sharing them so freely and so candidly. And now I know you would not want to leave this auditorium or gymnasium this evening without me presenting to you the lovely and charming wife of the Vice President of the United States. Mrs. Nixon, will you come to the stage? Again, thank you, Mr. Vice President, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
You have just heard an address and question and answer period by the Vice President of the United States, Richard M. Nixon, coming directly from the Florida Gymnasium on the campus of the University of Florida. Tonight, after arriving late by plane from Washington, the Vice President spoke to an audience of some 10,000. Mr. Nixon and his party plan to leave tonight for Miami, where he'll be speaking to Republican delegations. Among those accompanying Nixon on his trip were his wife, Pat, and the National Broadcasting Company's distinguished news correspondent, Herb Kaplow. So, ladies and gentlemen, from the Florida Gymnasium on the University of Florida campus, and speaking for the new staff of WRUF, this is Rex Anthony returning you to the main studios of the Voice of Florida.
WRUF and WRUF FM, Gainesville. We now join NBC News in progress.